Hello, I'm Naomi Pullen, and I'm interviewing Dr. Sasha Handley at the University of Manchester. Sasha's currently researching the fascinating topic of perceptions and practices of sleep in the 17th and 18th centuries.
That's right, yeah.
And working towards a monograph entitled Bedroom Stories in Early Modern England. So I'm just going to spend some time today talking to you mainly about your research and sort of your inspirations and kind of where they've come from. So first of all, I'll start quite generally and just ask you what it was that kind of got you into history. Like what, what sort of really drove you towards kind of pursuing a career in academia and even studying at university? Big question.
It is so many different things. I was the first person in my family ever to go to university, mm-hmm. and so history was just one of the three A-level subjects that I seemed to be all right at. I'm not quite sure there was more to the picking at degree level than that, but it was really my experience here at Warwick, actually, I think, encouraged me to pursue it at postgrad level and postdoctoral level, because I don't think I'd ever kind of set out wanting to be an historian or believing that I was capable of it until I came here, actually. And I remain very much a product of the Warwick brand, if you like, because the sort of social history, social and cultural history that I was introduced to here has always been a thing that's driven all of my projects and driven
Absolutely.
My enthusiasm.
Yeah.
The ordinary people who get ignored are the people that I am most interested in finding out about. And that, I think, is true of both of my projects.
Absolutely.
In fact, I'm slightly annoyed that my paper today is going to be about posh people. Because sometimes you just can't avoid it.
Absolutely. But it's also one of the joys of studying early modern history as well, because reconstructing those stories are much more challenging in some ways, I think. And that's
yes, they can be.
Part one of the joys as well of studying them.
Yeah.
And how about, so you're currently working on sleep and dreams and representations?
Not really on dreams.
Okay.
I've decided to avoid that black hole for now,
okay.
just because it's such a vast scholarship
Absolutely.
In and of itself. I was trying to delimit this project in some ways,
mm-hmm.
because so little has been written about it. It just means that I've gone off already in
yes.
too many different directions, so I'm sort of keeping dreams for a later date.
Absolutely.
But yes, I'm interested in representations of sleep, but also in the kind of physical everyday experience of it. So I think that probably is reflected in the different kinds of source materials that I use.
Absolutely.
Starting with household inventories, probate inventories, moving through to guides to household management, a lot of medical texts, medical advice books, because I'm interested in that context of sleep, its relationship on health. But I am also interested particularly in the way that sleeplessness is represented
okay.
in the later 18th century, because it seems to me that various sleep disorders become fashionable because
okay.
they advertise a greater degree of sensibility and intelligence. At least that's the way they are presented in the materials that I've been reading.
Absolutely. I guess you've got more time to kind of pursue other activities and not get distracted, maybe? I don't know.
I hope so.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But how about, I'm quite interested, like when I was like looking at your research, I was thinking like, do they actually have advice literature then on sleep and on kind of, say, is there a particular space where it's better to sleep than others? Do they really go into that much detail?
Yes, absolutely. There's a huge health literature about what is the optimum sleeping environment. I'm interested at the moment in the what I've called the vertical relocation mm-hmm. of bed chambers and bedsteads from ground floor multifunctional parlours to more specialised upstairs chambers. And, you know, there are various reasons. I think there are various reasons that that seems to happen from the late 17th mm-hmm. century onwards. But one of those reasons is about health concerns and having access to purer, healthier air. The higher up you are, the better it is. But I think there are also lots of interesting parallels about social status
and absolutely.
That kind of corresponds to the height of beds themselves. If you look at the height difference between a servant's bed and the master or mistress, it's sort of very clear to see you know, who's got all the money and the power.
Absolutely, so,
That's the cold, damp floors, the closer you are to the cold, damp floor, you know, the less beneficial for your health. So there are lots of, there's so much advice about where to position the bedstead. Should it be in the direct line of the moon? No, because that's damaging to the brain. So there's lots of information about humoral balance and different parts of the body that need to be protected from the night air, which is generally believed to be quite dangerous.
And do you see that shifting as you move into the 18th century? Do you see that kind of thing becoming more informed by science, like scientific discoveries?
Well, I think it was always underpinned by medicine and natural philosophy.
Absolutely.
And the humoral tradition, I think, does persist quite a long way into the 18th century, in relation to sleep at least. But I do see more emphasis on ventilation, and that kind of ties up with interesting research in of Enlightenment physicians and philosophers about the properties of the air, and they do devise things like ventilators for domestic use that can be attached to the bottom of window panes, so you have the requisite amount of air flow during the night, and physicians start to warn against the use of thick, heavy bed curtains to surround the bed because they prevent the free circulation of air, whereas previously they were believed to be good for health because they kept you warm and they gave you some privacy from what was going on around you. So there are subtle shifts, I think.
And do you see an overlap between sort of the prescribed theories and the actual practices? Is this the kind of thing that you can actually evidence sort of in, say, probate inventories?
I'm trying to, although probate inventories are not particularly helpful for documenting practice.
No.
Which is why I have a big stock of personal testimonies to help me along the way. So I know, for example, that people like James Woodford, 18th century clergyman, has a thermometer in his bed chamber so he can regulate the temperature. He's very annoyed when he has to keep the window closed because it's the middle of winter, because he thinks this is damaging to his health. So there are lots of ways in which people, I think, selectively absorb some of these ideas, although I don't think they kind of introduce them wholesale, because it's always negotiated with individual household needs. But yeah, The part that I'm interested in is that kind of interaction between what people are actually doing and what they're being told is good for them. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that case study. Are there any particular like primary sources that you think have really helped to define this project, or have perhaps altered your preconceptions about? It's a tough question.
I suppose I'd always intended to look at probate inventories. Mm-hmm. In some ways, the conclusions that I've drawn from them are fairly predictable. That's what I hope to find. I think the same with the medical texts as well. What I find most interesting are the personal testimonies, the letters and the diaries. What's annoying and frustrating about them is that everyday sleeping habits are so taken for granted that they generally only get commented on if something has gone wrong or disrupted them. That's where you kind of read between the lines as to what normally happens, but you don't necessarily have people telling you directly how they go about preparing themselves for sleep every night.
Yeah.
One aspect that I've become increasingly interested in, and I've written an article about, but would like to do some more on, is the religious significance of sleep.
Yes.
And bedside prayers, the place of they occupy in daily devotional activities, and the idea of the bedchamber as a kind of liminal space.
Absolutely.
Between this world and the next. I'm quite interested
yeah.
in that.
That's fascinating, and in my own research on Quaker women as well, I often find that they have they experience their visions and their sort of religious experiences whilst they're in bed,
right.
quite often surrounded by other women as well, which I think is interesting.
Right. But... Oh, yes, you have to tell me more about that.
That sounds excellent. what I was. Going to do, or what one thing I saw when I was looking through your research was the tours that you do that you have done at Ham House, and I
was there just this weekend.
Were you?
Yeah.
and your it's a tour about sleeping chairs, is that
I take in the sleeping chair,
right,
which is at the house. Yes.
And what exactly is this?
What is it? That's a good question. It is a very comfortable and elegant looking chair, which has a reclining mechanism, so you can lower the back, and it also has two padded side panels, mm-hmm. on which you can imagine somebody easily resting their heads. This was commissioned in the 1670s by the Duke and Duchess of Lauderdale, and there's a pair of these things. The other one is a private ownership somewhere in Norfolk, I think. But I think it's something that's increasingly used for short daytime naps. Mm. And that is something that seems to become part and parcel of elite noble households in the late 17th and 18th century. I sort of thought a bit about how habits of sociability change people's daily schedules,
yeah.
and also their bedtimes. And this seems to coincide with the emergence of lots of very comfy padded furniture. chaise longues, day beds, reposing chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Chippendale designs things that are multifunctional. You can use them in the daytime, but then there's a set of curtains that you can draw around if you want to have a little sleep. But the sleeping chair at Ham, I don't think was particularly successful, because somebody was once allowed to sit in it. And when they reclined the back, apparently it flipped over backwards. it was, however, probably the predecessor of the Queen Anne wing chair, which I think the first visual depiction of it is 1714. It's a picture of Alexander Pope sitting in a wing chair, unable to sleep. He's a notorious insomniac. And that is something which obviously we still have with us today.
Absolutely.
So obviously the design of that was much more successful and easily integrated with Georgian interior. So there were probably some connections to be made there by somebody who's much more of a specialist in the history of furniture than me.
But it's fascinating the overlap between sort of that materiality and kind of, you know, how sleep is kind of understood and represented. And just briefly before we finish, I was just wondering if you could just say a bit more about where you see your research going, and are there any sort of other ideas or projects in the pipeline? I mean, we were talking about maybe...
I know I've been working on sleep for a long time, but I still feel at the beginning of this project. There are so many things that I would like to write relating to it, offshoots of it. Today's paper is, you know, potentially one of those things, to get more into the kind of material culture side of it. But I'm also at the moment going back to the ghosts, where I started with the PhD. A colleague of mine, Jenny Spinks, and I are putting on an exhibition in Manchester in 2016 about magic and the early modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find myself retracing my steps to the Wesley family ghost, the John Wesley's family ghost, which is very richly documented episode, and the manuscript is in situ in the John Rylands Library in Manchester. So I've now had that digitised, and I'm working my way through it, and think I need to go to the Epworth Records, the parish where this all took place, to sort of find out what was going on. John Wesley's father seemed to have fallen out with many of his parishioners, and I wonder whether this was a kind of act of revenge on their part. But it's very interesting the way that the story is interpreted at local level, and then the way in which it is kind of taken up in print and connected to all these confessional battles throughout the 18th century, right the way through to Joseph Priestley and the Unitarian movement in the 1780s and 90s. So that's on the horizon.
But it's fascinating really how you've kind of almost gone, you're returning to your roots, and it's actually a similar experience I've had. Just moving, thinking about where I'm going to move my PhD forward, I'm sort of actually going back to my master's material and thinking that there's actually more scope there than I thought there was. So
yeah, I suppose there must be reasons why I'm drawn to certain topics.
Absolutely,
The more I get into sleep, the more parallels I see with the ghosts.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
With supernatural phenomena. So yeah, we'll see.
Excellent. Okay, well, we'll finish there. Thank you.